ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओमंगलं गुरुदेवाय देव्ये मत्रिक्ष मंगलं मंगलं भक्ता वृंदेव्यो सर्वालोकाय मंगलं ओम सारशिव समारंभं शंकराचार्य मध्यमं अश्मराचार्य प्रायंतं वंदे गुरुं परंपरं. So it's been a few weeks since we've been reading, I think maybe 3 weeks or something. And where we left off, we're in the story right now, we're in the seventh skanda of Srimad Bhagavatam, the story of Prahlad. Bhakta Prahlad was Hiranyakashipu and Narasimha, a very famous story. Most people here know the gist of that story. Where we left off, the great demon Hiranyakashipu had a very divine son who was born pure soul, pure with pure devotion, full knowledge. Because in the mother's womb, he heard the holy name of Narayan, Om Namo Narayana, and he heard the teachings of Narada Muni while still in the mother's womb. And so he was born in that perfect, pure devotional state. And Hiranyakashipu at that time had taken over, in the story, that he has taken over, not just, he'd become Lord of the Demons. He then took over the human realm, became Lord of the human realms. And then he had even attacked Indraloka and the Devaloka. And so all the gods also were his servants. He had mastered everybody. He sat on Indra throne, controlling the entire universe. Powerful, seemingly very, very powerful. And he had got this ability by getting a unique boon, which most people here know that he couldn't be killed by... He wanted to be immortal, but he couldn't be immortal. But he got a boon from Lord Brahma that he couldn't be killed inside or outside, on the ground or in the sky, by man or animal, by anybody created by Brahma, like this. So many night and day, by weapon or by hand, different situation, thinking this way nobody could challenge him. He had no rival. His idea of immortality was not spiritual immortality. The soul is by nature immortal. But the immortality comes that nobody could defeat him, becoming undefeated. Nobody could kill him. And so bit by bit, he could take over everything. And so his dear son, he sent his son to school. We learned to learn diplomacy, politics and diplomacy. He went to what they learned in school. And his son, he didn't appreciate what the teachers were teaching him. He was a good student. He'd hear and repeat what they said, but he never accepted it. And so when he first went to his father's lap to find out, his father asked him, "What did you learn in school?" He says, "I learned that what's best in this world? What all the things you've learned, what is best?" He says, "I think the best education is that everybody should leave their home, go into the forest, and worship Narayan." So this was not what the teacher what Hiranyakashipu wanted to hear. So he sent him back to school and threatened his teachers, who taught him a little more carefully. Actually, he says very carefully, teaching him the three goals of life, which is how to enjoy in this world. Like wealth, do your duties in your family and country, and enjoyment. They left out moksha, the final goal, the spiritual goal, with the speak of bhakti, right, devotion. They left out all the spiritual things. They taught him how to be a good materialistic person, what you learn in school. I was also taught this in school, so I know we were all taught this like this. And so the second time he went, he got sent to his father to find out what he learned in school. He gave a very famous answer. He says, "What did you learn in school?" "I learned that the real education is Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu, to hear and to chant about God, Smaranam, to remember God, to pray to God, to worship God, to become His servant, to serve His feet, to become His friend." And then completely surrender oneself to God. This is what I learned. I think this is the highest education, right? He said, "Anything else? Real training should be in these activities: how to hear, speak, remember, worship, befriend, serve, and finally, ultimately, fully surrender." Called Nava Bhakti, the nine forms of bhakti. This is real education. So his father, hearing this, threw into a huge rage. right? And he decided this boy actually does the scene. Most of you weren't here, so I'm giving a little bit of background. He says he took the boy on his lap, smelled his hair, did a very affectionate way, kind of kissed his head, equivalent of that, and so with tears in his eyes, seeing his beloved son, what did you learn in school today? Hearing this, he took the boy and threw him on the floor, right? You can imagine from 1 second to another, what changed. He says that you become my enemy. You become the killer of my brother. Because in the backstory, Vishnu had killed his brother, right? Hiranyaksha, another great demon. And so he says, by taking his side, if you're not for me, if you're for him, you're against me, right? You've taken sides. And this is one of the major ideas that Prahlad presented to his father. He says that the problem also is that we're seeing everything. We're seeing difference where there's no difference. We're seeing that our happiness is independent of other people's happiness. This is a problem. And by this worship of Vishnu, this worship of God, remembering all this is purified. All this is, I think it's a light bulb. All these impure things in the heart, selfishness in the heart, and sense of separation washed away, and then we can get devotion. So hearing this, this time he threw him on the ground, and he says, told his ministers and his attendants, kill this boy with whatever means necessary. Right? And so it's described, they threw him, they trampled him under elephants. Nothing happened to him. They threw him in a pit of poisonous snakes. Nothing happened to him. They threw him off a cliff. Nothing happened to him. They tried to drown him in water. Nothing happened to him. Tried to burn him in fire. Nothing happened. Like this, bit by bit, everything they tried to do. They tried to cut him, burn him, wet him, like this, right? All these things. But nothing happened to him. And so we're giving some, by our Guruji's, our Guru's inspiration, this is an ancient story that's being told for a purpose, right? So it's some symbolism. Symbolism is also there as a metaphor. It's an ancient history, but it's being told to teach something. And that's counterbalancing the Hiranyakashi ego is just trying to get full control, unthwarted power, unchallenged power, right? The Hiranyakashipu, right? Compared to this little boy who doesn't do any austerity. He's simply born pure. And we're all born little boy. All these boys, all the boys and girls are born pure. Some with a special memory from their past, maybe. Some spiritual awakening. And that the soul, Prahlad, is that purity of the soul. The pure nature of the pure soul. And given the right environment, he was in the environment of the Narada Muni. Right, so even in his mother's womb, in that very good company, his natural purity woke up. Right, no problem. Right, and so it's not something he gained. It was his own. It's a soul's quality, devotion, love, humility, oneness. All these are the actual quality. Not something we have to learn. You don't have to go to school to actually. We lose these things. He was sent to school to lose these things, and we also get sent to school very often to lose our innocence and purity. You know, we're taught. The hard cash of reality, of the hard knocks of life, the rules of how to live in this world, how to succeed and compete in this world. And so by trying to kill him, Eckley describes, those verses are right in front of me right now, but basically he tried to cut him, wet him, dry him, burn him. In the Gita, Krishna says, the soul can never be cut. My weapon cannot be burned by fire, dried by wind, wetted by water, like this, right? Because it's eternal. So the Prahlad is the quality of the soul. Actually, Prahlad, Amiganda helped me with the dictionary. Ahlada means joy. And the word pra is a preface that makes something like, it accentuates and adds a lot of divine dignity to the word in front of it. Like deep and pradeep, you know, like, or pra akash, pra, it's like a spiritual, it's like extreme supreme joy that awoken. Right, nothing that Hiranyakashipu could do could stop it, and so then he has the last verse we read last week or 3 weeks ago. Last time we read, he had this very deep, fearful realization. He had this little boy. No matter what I've done, he's fearless, and he seems to be immortal. These two, he's not fearing. He doesn't fear me or my entire universal army of demons, humans, and gods who are under his control, and nothing we can do can kill him, and that's what Hiranyakashipu wanted during his austerities. He wanted to be nobody, to fear nobody, and to be immortal. And then he thought, nobody can kill me. No, I cannot be killed by anybody. But now I'm thinking, since I went against him and persecuted him, that could be the cause of my death. That's where we left off. He thought that my going against him would be the cause of my death. Right, and we see what happens. The ego, we can live with our ego, right? Most people's ego is not so bad, right? Right? We quite a spiritual, like keep our ego under control and develop our spiritual life. But when the ego and this, when the purity, our spiritual awakening happens, and the ego just tries to fight it, between a fight between God and the ego, who's going? We know all the stories between Krishna, Rama and Ravana, Krishna and Kamsa, Durga and Mahishasura, and all those. All those fights, God always wins, right? So he says, by fighting God, by finding this purity, I think that's going to be my destruction. And we find eventually this is what happens. So he gets scared and sends him back to school. And the teacher said, no, it's okay. He has some bad company somehow or another from his past, or maybe some people snuck in. But our guru's coming, Shukracharya, the demon of the gods. In his care, he'll learn properly, right? He'll be good company. Right, so this is where we left off, and I'll read the last few verses of the last chapter that describes the scene. Whenever the teachers went out on their own household purposes, Prahlad's classmates, who then got time to play, would call him to join him. On one such occasion, this enlightened Prahlada spoke to them lovingly for their own instruction, depicting the very pitiful condition of men steeped in worldly life. The boys, whose minds had not yet been corrupted by the words and examples of the extremely worldly-minded fellow Asuras, were powerfully attracted by the weight and seriousness of Prahlad's words. They threw away their playthings and gathered around him, concentrating their looks and their hearts on him. To them, the great devotee Prahlad spoke as follows, with a mind full of love and pity. So what he says, his classmates were all the fellow demons, right? They're daitas. Actually, the term here is daita children, the children of the daitas, right? But he would tell them, when the teachers go away, he'd tell them, what are we going to school for? We're going to school only to learn how to live good worldly lives. What's the value of that? What's the ultimate value of this? So these are very famous verses, very famous teachings, and they're very, our friend Tushita Krishna calls them cutting words. They're very sharp, right? So please don't, I'm reading, it's told by a five-year-old boy to his five-year-old classmates. So we're told, right? But really what's the story? The story is being told by Narada to Yudhisthira, but really the story is being told by Parikshit to by Sukadev to Parikshit, but really it's being told. We take a giant step; it's being told by Vedavyas to us, right? We need to hear the words. It's the story. This little conversation, the safest part, little boy like this talking to his friends. It seems safe to hear such words, right? If my guru were to kind of immediately say, "What are you doing? Live this worldly life. You're wasting your life. Live," we'd be shocked and scared by such. So you have to put it in words of in the purest, most scary mouths, right? But the words are very strong. So it starts. Sri Prahlad Uvacha. Prahlad said, uses the word prajna, the wise one who knows, prajna, one wise person. Should practice Bhagavat Dharma. Bhagavat Dharma is the Dharma of the Bhagavat, or devotion, this devotional tradition of chanting, hearing, remembering, worshipping, praying, surrendering, befriending God, right? Keeping God in the center and letting our devotion automatically spring towards that center. So they should practice this Bhagavat Dharma from their very youth. So he's telling his children, you're going for education. The real educated person, the real wise person, from very childhood, from youth, begin to practice devotional life, Bhagavad Dharma. For in this life, what is this life? He means human life, right? A human body. Alone can we attain our objective, right? But this life, this body, is very rare and very temporary. That's the thing. We should start while we're young. Start now, right? Because actually, who's telling it? Vedavyas is speaking to us, or Parikshit is speaking, Sukha is speaking to Parikshit, who's on his deathbed, right? He has 7 days to live. By this point, he probably has 4 or 5 days to live, 3 days to live, right? And the sage is telling him, you should start from very youth, right? He shouldn't be lamenting, oh, I didn't start when I was young, I'm in no hope. Start now. This means start now. Now is our youth, right? Why? Because this body is very difficult to get. And it seems only in this body can we attain our real spiritual objective, right? There's many stories of animals attaining liberation, but usually by the grace of saints, right? You know, a saint would say something to a saint and be illumined, and the animal would become illumined, or we had so many stories like that. But we don't know. This is from a human perspective. The animals have their own scriptures where they tell everybody, if you waste your life, you may be more as a human and get caught in this political cycle of, you know, so who knows from their perspective, but from our perspective, saying that this human body, only this human body, spiritual life seems to be possible. And this human body is very rare. How difficult it is to get. Out of all living entities in this room, how many have human bodies? There's probably about 20 of us here, 30 of us here. There's probably a billion living entities in this room. Cells and animals and bugs and insects and worms and, you know, it's like so many plants, so many things, so many living entities and so many bodies. The souls are the same, right? How long did it take to get from some worm on one of the flowers to a human body, right? So many, maybe thousands of lives. Who knows? Maybe it could have been offered on a flower to mom, maybe next life. Who knows? We don't know how it works, right? By the spiritual power of being offered. The pujari will get in trouble for not washing the flower properly and offering flower with worm, but the worm will become maybe advanced. Right, but so out of all humans, difficult. It says in the scriptures that there's so many. There's you have to go through even to get a human body. You have to go through 8 million wombs. You have to be born 8 million different species before you get a human body, and then so many times we're born the human being before our spiritual awareness awakens. Right, they say 8 million. Actually, it's 400,000 species of human variety. Not species, varieties of humans, to the spiritually ripe human who has some devotion awakening. Right, so if we have a human body and we're all here on a Saturday night, so there's some. So really, we got two things. We have that spiritual awakening, right? But human body seems is rare and temporary, because one thing we know for sure, we're going to die, and what our next body is not clear, right? When it is and where it is and what it is not clear. There was one Swami I knew, Hiranya Maharaj. He said that. Now we have life is birth, old age, disease, and death. This is a common Vedic term. But he added one more, and rebirth of an indeterminate nature. That's what we have. We don't know what the future is. We don't know. Will we get another human body? Probably, but no guarantee. Right? We assume this, but that's our assumption. Not fact. We don't know. Right. So what's our next body? So it's temporary, so this body is temporary, and what our next body is. And it says, and Prahlad saying, only in this body can we attain our real objective, the goal of education. The wise should practice Bhagavad Dharma from their very youth. For in this life alone can we attain our objective, but it is extremely rare and temporary. A person should worship the lotus feet of Vishnu, Vishnu Paro Pasarpanam. What should we do in this very life? Worship. This is the Vaishnava text. We're worshiping Vishnu. We're going to worship Ma. We should worship the Sah. Worship Shiva. Worship God. You know, put their mind on God. Why? Because he is actually. Where is the term? Sarva Bhutanam Priya Atma Ishvara Suhrit. He is the dearmost friend of every Sarva Bhuta, of everyone. Why should we? Because what we want is union with our friend, with our dearest friend, who actually will make us happy. He's our dearest friend. He's Atma Ishvara. Atma Ishvara has two meanings. He's the Lord of our soul, Lord of our heart, or he's the self of everything and the Lord of everything. He's our very own self and our Lord. Right? He's the core of your being and the one you're hungering for. Right? And that's a great mystery. Our Guruji used to say that in a wonderful term. He says, he is you whom you seek. He is you whom you seek. And he seeks all of you. He's your loving friend calling you. Therefore, a person should worship the lotus feet of Vishnu, who is dear, the self, the Lord, the friend of all beings. So what about Why are they going to school? Why do we go to school? Why should we go to school? I'm not against going to school. Why should we? Why we be in order? Because we have to get the necessary skills. Why? Right. In order to get more happiness, right, pleasure, and to avoid pain. That seems to be material life is here to find is working for happiness or pleasure, right, and avoiding suffering. That's material life. If that's material life, that's for many people, many religious, or maybe ourselves, this could be our religious life also. We want to get to heaven and avoid hell. That's an expansion. Swami Vivekananda said that's an expansion of material life. He says the same. That mentality is material mentality, right? We put that in this life, we put that in the next life also, right? But so he starts, he says, by destiny, sensual pleasures come by virtue of having a body, right? Even from body in every form of life, as the suffering without any endeavor. So this is a difficult thing for us to accept, but it's in a certain sense a fact. If you try to be happy, try to be miserable, sometimes we want to be miserable, sometimes you're happy. It just happens, right? You have to eat something to keep alive. Sometimes something tastes good. Somebody makes a joke and you laugh. You cannot not be happy sometimes. You cannot not sometimes. Some things in the world of the senses, where there's pleasure and pain, sometimes you're in pleasure. And no matter how much you try to attain pleasure, sometimes you get pain. Actually, sometimes the more you try to attain pleasure, when you fail, so much pain comes. When you attain your goal, that goal is temporary, so that will end. The goal is never what you really want. That's also so he says that our pleasure and pain, you don't have to do anything and still you get pleasure and pain. You don't need to work independently. So every animal also gets pleasure and pain, right? Every animal, gets happiness and misery, right? And every species of life. This is not unique to human species. Every species, pleasure and pain is fixed. Actually, it says daiva means by God's plan, right? If you have a body, you experience pleasure and you experience pain. You don't need to do anything to endeavor it. So a whole education, your whole life orientation, your political systems, economic systems, everything is based upon getting pain and avoiding pleasure, right? You don't need to do any of that, and you still get pain and pleasure, right? So it's like he's dismissing the whole structure of, can't say modern society, because this is society, the story is told 5,000 years ago, and it refers to a story told in a previous age. Previous creation cycle, right, in a different universe, right? It is universally true, right? Everywhere true. So why he's asking you, what we're learning is not what we should be learning, because if we don't do anything, I went to school, maybe not full school, but I have a good, decent college education from a decent school. I did moderately well, right? And so I have some happiness and some misery. And there's people who didn't go to school at all, didn't go to drop out of high school, and so also they get happiness and misery, right? It's people who work really, really hard, and they get happiness and misery. People who don't work out, there's lazy people who sit in the corner and do anything, they're happy and get misery, right? It's a harsh thing, because that's just, it shakes the very structure of our goal-oriented society. We should be goal-oriented. What's our goal? Is it physical happiness and avoiding pain? Nothing. We needn't do nothing for it. So such endeavors need not be done. That's a big statement. For it only wastes our lifespan, right? Something we don't need to do, and that we'll get even if we don't do it, and we do it, our whole life is being wasted. Our goal, only in this life, which is temporary and difficult to attain, right? Rare and difficult to attain and temporary, can we attain our goal. And by focusing on things that we'll get anyways, we're wasting our goal. We're wasting our life, our lifespan. And it does not lead to the enjoyment of our real goal. Right? That all this endeavor wastes our life, and it doesn't lead to our ultimate goal, our real goal. Right? What's our real goal? Here it says, Mukunda Charanambuja, the lotus feet of Mukunda, of God, of Vishnu, Krishna. Mukunda, actually, the one who gives liberation. Right, the one who frees us from our bondage, right? That's our real goal, right? So we have to, he's saying these little boys and girls, or the us little boys and girls, unnecessary endeavor only wastes our life, and doesn't allow us to get our real ultimate goal. Therefore, actually, the term is tato yatera kushala. Therefore, kushala means, it's a common name, kushala is a common name also. Kushala means clever, right? It means expert, intelligent, but actually means clever, always clever person, right? Clever, we want to be clever. We should use our clever means, has flavors of meaning, of course, right? But a clever, intelligent person, a wise person, after having fallen into this world, the seeming world of material existence, should strive to attain the goal before this body falls, right? While we may, if we've fallen into this physical body in this physical world, therefore now, back to the opening verse, while we, before we die, we should strive, right, to attain the goal. And he said, before it falls, and pushkalam, and while it's still, while we're still strong, these two points, before we die and while we're still healthy. I sometimes think right now I'm living a sadhana life and sannyasi life. I'm trying to chant and do puja and read the scriptures like that, and I pray the rest of my life will be spent this way, right? But tomorrow I could get in an accident and have a brain injury, right? And all of a sudden, who knows? I could spend the rest of my life could be ended tomorrow. Or it could end in 50 years, but my spiritual life may end tomorrow. We don't know. We can hope and pray. But right today, I'm healthy. Today, I have some strength. So today, I should strive. What is that striving? Shravanam, kirtanam, smaranam, to chant, to listen, to remember God, surrender to God, Bhagavad Dharma. So this is very good. It starts, man lives 100 years. This is, of course, this is perhaps at our best, we're supposed to live 100 years. That's the natural life. But actually, the commentators of this verse says 100 years means our life, right? We live 100 years, right? But an ant also lives its life 100 years. Its life may be 1 week, right? Lord Brahma lives 100 years. He also lives 100 years. His days are considered 100, so he lives thousands of years, hundreds of thousands, millions of years, his life. But it's still, he's born, he grows up, he gets married, has a family, gets a job, settles down, gets old, he lives his life. A moth, you know, you see a June bug comes up, and within 24 hours, it's dead. Right? We're getting June bugs this week, they're in my mind. You can see them, they come up, and you know, I feel sorry for them, in the day they're gone. But it's lived its life. It woke up. It flew around, found a mate, laid its eggs, had children, and died, right? And we do it in 100 years, or 80 years, or 70 years, or hopefully we get a healthy lifespan. But whatever it is, means whatever our span of life, supposed to be 100 years, the time is not important. What's told is how to use our time. Half of this, our life, our 100 years, or our 50 years, whatever it is spent for one who is totally without self-control, half of this is fruitless. Half of the 100 years has no spiritual benefit because we're sleeping, right? We're sleeping during half of it. We're not striving. Of course, our spirit, sleep has its own value. Each one of these points we could argue, but that's not the point of it. This story is being told to get us to utilize this life properly. It's designed to wake us to realize life is short, death is certain, while there is time, worship God, as Shankaracharya says, right? This is the ultimate message being told here. So half of our 100 years is without fruit for one who is without self-control, right? There's yogis, they use their sleep properly, they minimize their sleep. Their sleep is done properly in a spiritual way to have spiritual dreams. You know, it can be done. It's just for most centrally bound people when our sense is out of control, we sleep. Myself, this is one of my crimes here. Sleep too much. Half of this spending the night sleeping in ignorance, covered by tamaha, and by the darkness of ignorance, inertia, tamaguna. Right, in sleep, the mind is just blotted out by tamaguna. We're being pinned down, right? So imagine, of course, 8 hours is supposed to be the maximum, but imagine if you're sleeping 12, 13, 14 hours, whole day can be spent sleeping. Okay, so out of what's left, 20 years is the first 20 years of our life is spent in, it says actually it's split into 10, in the ignorance of child infanthood, of small children. Of course, they're not ignorant. Prahlad is speaking the highest truth. But this is the point that we're not going to do much spiritual practice when we're 2 years old, 3 years old, 4 years old, 10 years old, right? The next 10 years is spent in the playthings of youth, games, right? That's also important. We're not dismissing, but it's still a fact. Half 10 years is spent in childhood, next 10 years in youth, sport, goofing off, going to, you know, having fun, right? Right. Actually, this is not a criticism of youth or childhood. This is a statement that for our goal, how much time do we have to practice? This is the question. Right. Another 20 years is spent in suffering, decrepitude, and helplessness. This is in our old age. The last 20 years, from 80 to 100. If you make it to be 80, if we live to be 100 years, the last 20 years, it's not going to be pleasant most of the time. We get sick, we get old, we're helpless, we can't do what we want. Even if we want to do something, we can't do it. Even to get up, we may not be able, even to go to the bathroom by ourselves, we may not be able to do, to speak of more difficult things. It's a fact. This is a harsh reality. So if you think 20 years, the first 20 years in childhood, the last 20 years, how many years is that left? That's 20 and 20 and 100 years. That's 60, right? So, but also that 60, half of it spent in sleep. So 30. Okay, maybe we have 30 in a 100-year life, or in our full life, or you can say 30% of our life is left to ourselves to do something, right? 1/4, or I guess math is not what I went to school for. So forgive me, even simple math I can't do. Anyways, so what do we have left? The remaining 30 years, the remaining part, which is not 60 years, but 30 years, because half it's in sleep, are wasted by one who is very attached to material life, right? Bewildered by, beautiful term, kama. Kama means lust, right? The desire for enjoyment, right? But here it says, dura purena. Dura purena means that lust, that desire, which can never be fulfilled. The latter is trying desperately to get the happiness which can never be got. If you have desire, you can never... Fulfillment of desire... Everybody knows fulfilling desire does not satisfy desires. It's very hard to fulfill our desires perfectly, which leads to frustration. When we get desires, we fulfill our desires, you get depressed that it wasn't as satisfying as you'd hoped, right? And it just awakens more desires. So it's like how there's a saying, I think maybe Bharata Hari or one of the ancient sages, I forget the exact term, the exact source, but it says that every woman in the world, all the money in the world, all the food in the world, all the pleasures in the world cannot satisfy one man full of desires, right? Everything, you can't get everything, but if you did, it still wouldn't satisfy you if you had awakened desires. So the last 30 years or 30%, is spent if by trying to fulfill desires that could never be satisfied. This is Prahlad's, like I said, they're sharp, sharp words. Where are we here? And by insatiable lust and overwhelming infatuation. And then he asks some strong questions to his little boys or to us, right? If our goal is just put the mind on God, right? But we're not being trained like this. This can be interpreted also. Bhagavad Dharma has many layers. It's not only the devotional tradition, but it's the social orientation, the training we get from childhood. Basically, he's told we should be trained from childhood to remember God and to be a little self-controlled and realize the ultimate goal of life is God, the love of God, and God realization, right? So this is based upon that old system of Varnashram. Actually, Varna, which is from childhood, we live almost like yogis. In ancient times, whether or not it really existed in its idealized form, the scriptural ideal form is from about 12 to 24, one goes to the ashram of the guru, or in the house of the guru and gets trained, right, in spiritual life and disciplined and things this, right? We have some, in our youth, we spend a little time in self-discipline and meditation. Then if we wish, and those desires are there, we can to get married and have a family and work in this world, then we can, we do though, but we've had so many years by with daily meditation, daily service of others, putting other people first, bit by bit. So not, so we don't do it in a completely selfish way, and we don't forget God, right? And we also learn some principles of self-discipline, how to live honestly and purely like this, right? And so that little part of our youth, the 30%, is not completely wasted. You can still, if we train, the point is not to criticize any of this. The point, his argument is we should start young. If we start young, then all these phases, our old life can be golden. Our youth can be golden. Our marriage and family can be golden, right? You know, all the stages of life could be God-centered, right? And developing Bhagavad Dharma is not sannyas dharma. It's not giving up the world and renouncing the world. Bhagavad Dharma is devotional life, right? So if we start young, then all aspects, we don't have to forget God at any of these points, right? So we can. So it says, what person who is attached, who is this unnaturally or attached to the home, who has uncontrolled senses, and who is bound strongly by the ropes of affection, can liberate himself from bondage? Who can give up the thirst for wealth, dearer than life? Right. Once you're in that world, how can you give up? Like any, you know, there's people who are millions and millions of dollars, and they're still. Srila Prabhupada, the Hare Krishna founder, he had a very famous line. He says, "But when you're struggling and you're poor, you don't have time. You have so much work to do to raise money for your family and yourself and your family. You have no time for a good breakfast, a cup of tea, and you're off, right? And then once you succeed and you're a multimillionaire, you have no time for a good breakfast, a cup of tea, and you're off. When do you have time to sit down with your family and eat a piece of toast or something? You know, he used to give that argument. There's no end to it, right? You know, so how can you give this up? A thirst for wealth, desiring which thieves and laborers and businessmen purchase this wealth at the cost of their precious lives. A thief, you know, how much soldiers, thieves, even a business, how we give our whole life trying to get a little bit of money. To get that little money, we trade in our life, our precious life, right? Or that 30% that we have still going, right? How can one give up the pleasurable private company of one's dear and affectionate spouse? Actually, the term is very couched. There's some slightly language. It's a slightly erotic term here, yet being couched in appropriate Bhagavatam. The pleasurable connection in private. You know, how can you give up sex life with your spouse? Because these little boys don't have anything. These are rhetorical questions, right? Unless, how can you put your mind on God and away from this, even in the midst of that? If you're in the middle of the family, and children and happiness and all these, you know, ups and downs of family life and the pleasures and pains of family life, without this training at youth, how can you take your mind away from that at will and put it on God? These are the questions. How can one give up the pleasurable private company of one's dear and affectionate spouse, the words of our loved ones and friends, and the charming prattle of children, which are so attractive to the mind? In the midst of it, how can we pull our mind out of it? How can one give up thinking about one's dear daughters, one's brothers and sisters, or one's sick and elderly parents? This is the big thing. Once you've entered the world, we see how difficult it is. If we have our, you know, we're all at that age where our parents are getting old, right? And how much anxiety, what can we do? Our parents need our help and our suffering. You know, we all have the people, many people here have to move back to India to take care of their parents, and it's a big struggle, right? How can we not, how can we pull our mind? We have to, we're bound to, right? How can one give up thinking of one's dear brothers, sisters, or of one's home, one's beautiful furniture, one's family business, one's animals, servants? Like, once you're in it, how can you pull the mind from this without proper training? How can one renounce who is bound like a silkworm by desire-motivated actions. Actually, this is a very interesting. Silkworm means, what is a bound like a silkworm? Silkworm creates out of his own self a cocoon, and then dies, and many die right in their own cocoon, of their own making. Right? This is a term. How can one... where is it? Sorry. I lost my page. Oh, here it is. Sorry. Ihamana. Lobata. Koshakriti va tejasam. Sorry. Desire-motivated action. This is kama, right? Our karma, right? Karma that's motivated by selfish desire has reactions. That's what we call it. We even say karma. Karma means the action. But now the way we, it's bad karma, good karma, it's a reaction. When you do something out of selfish desire, only out of selfish desire, then we create a reaction, good or bad. We're in that reaction. We then suffer the pleasure or pain of that reaction, which leads to more selfish reaction, to us to react to those reactions. And so we're how much freedom, our little bit of action, ourself, even seeming we're working to satisfy our desires, we get caught and we slowly by this cause and effect of selfish driven desire, we create a cocoon around ourselves. How can we get out? Right? How can one renounce who is bound like a silkworm by desire motivated actions, whose desires can never be satisfied? Again, if you try to satisfy, even you can never fully satisfy them. And then, so, if you don't have that higher goal, and you're only trying to enjoy in this world, what is there to enjoy in this world? Right, you can have money in a house and a family. Why have money in a house and a family? If we pull it down, this is a little harsh, because these words are harsh. It's basically for the pleasure of sex and food. Right. Ultimately, even Krishna says in the Gita, in that the divine demoniac chapter, I'm forgetting, towards the end, he says that we think when the demonic state of mind comes, we think, there's no God. There's no God above. No God in control. This whole world is only sex and food, right? That's all it is, right? This is it. If I want to enjoy physically and enjoy, why do I have a house for sex and food? Why do I have a family? Easy sex and food. Why do I have a job to get money to pay for sex and food, right? You know, like this is a struggle, and who can? So how can one renounce who is bound like a silkworm by desire-motivated actions, whose desires are never satisfied, and who considers sex and food as being the goals of life? Right? Actually, important, I'm forgetting the Sanskrit, but there's a couplet that describes all life, all animal life, right? And that is, all animals need and engage in four primary actions, right? That's eating, sleeping, mating, defending. Right, we have to eat. If we don't eat, we die. We have to defend ourselves. We need a place to live. Eating, sleeping. Sleeping means a safe place to sleep. Right, and so eating, sleeping, mating, defending. Right, so and the June bugs are doing that. The gods are doing that. We're doing that, and the dogs and cats are doing that. Right, nothing wrong. That's part of human. That's also part of human life. Human body means eating, sleeping, mating. You can eat less. You don't have to mate. There's adjustments to that. But basically, these are animal life, and so the challenge is, if we only do that, if that's the only goal of life, then we're not much different from animals, right? You know, then we're living animal life with our superior education, superior intellect, supposedly, our movable thumbs, you know, all the things that may have made us be able to think and act like this. Who knows, right? What are we doing? We have a very creative, sophisticated, technological ways of eating, sleeping, mating, defending. Open up a newspaper, right? And start just, and you mark with some marker these four things on every article. Something about health, something about politics, the economy, a romance, you know, like it's these points, you know, there's want, that, you know, these, everything falls into one of these categories. The only thing that doesn't fall in such categories, maybe, you may find it in the religion section, maybe. Even religion section is often, you know, I prayed to God and he gave me my car back, and, you know, what supernatural debt reduction. I saw that on TV on a Christian station 2 days ago. The term was supernatural debt liquidation. So it's like that becomes the same. That becomes, what is it? It becomes eating, sleeping, mating, defending, right? So work. So having a higher goal of life, that's the important. Working only for the family, one does not see that the goal of life is being defeated. If you only work for your happiness of you and your family, your little insular group of safe eating, sleeping, mating, defending, right? We're only lived in that little circle. We don't realize that our real purpose of being, our being itself is being defeated. Our little 30%, 30-year window or less window is being wasted, right? If we only think like that, we're wasting that little precious time. Even though one always suffers from the threefold sufferings, means suffering from our own mind that we create ourselves, suffering that other people create, and suffering that nature creates, like earthquakes and tornadoes. These are the three sufferings. We're also constantly suffering. One does not become remorseful, right? Although we're constantly suffering, constantly frustrated by ourselves, others, and the gods themselves and nature, we still don't realize, what am I doing, wasting, right? And we simply try to enjoy our little private world, our little family home, right? One whose mind is always absorbed in wealth will also steal and cheat others. Because once you make that the goal, then the goal of life is getting money for sex and food, right, and power, right? Then by any means necessary becomes, right? Your morality gets adjusted to how to succeed financially. That becomes the criteria whether something's good or bad, whether or not it's economically feasible, whether it saves a company money, increases money for your shareholders becomes a standard. Everything becomes immoral. You're willing to do anything as long as the economy, economic part is correct, right? And maximum money. One whose mind is always absorbed in wealth will also steal from and cheat others. Even knowing that one will be punished in this life or in the next, right? We know. You'll see people in the news, they're doing all kinds of illegal things, politicians and corporations. And they know if you get caught, you'll be put in jail, right? Your face on every TV show and everything like this, how embarrassing, right? But we also, we do bad and we're living, so we all know in our next, in after death, there may be some punishment, right? In this life, we can be punishment. There's danger, if not in this life, In a future life, after death, we won't get away with it, right? So it says, but still we do it, right? Once you make this the goal, you cannot not do it. This is Prahlad's statement. So he's scaring these little kids. If we don't start now, you'll do anything for material enjoyment, without thought of any suffering caused by you to you or others. Knowing that one will be punished in this life, in life and in death, one still steals because of uncontrolled senses, unsatisfied desires, and attachment to one's family unit, to one's home. Although learned, actually now he uses the word vidvan. Vidvan is a classic term. Vidvan means an educated person. That's a very good thing. In India, people say, oh, he's vidvan. That's sadhu, he's vidvan. He's also not only a good sadhu, he has good knowledge. You know, all the scriptures, he knows a lot. Vidvan is a good compliment to give somebody. Although learned, vidvan, O children of the demons, right? These are all his classmates, right? Those who are attached to serving their family. Family, once again, it's not against the family. This is, I have to be careful how to mean the book. Family is, once you think me and mine, me, I and mine, my family, my community, my caste, my race, my religion, my country, my, you know, it's like you expand, it's still a selfish unit. When one becomes very attached to serving only one's own interest, one's and one's extended interest, right? Cannot swaluk purusham swaluk na kalpateve, cannot know one's own self, right? One cannot have self-knowledge. Although learned, O children of demons, those who are attached to serving their family or that unit, cannot know themselves because they cannot overcome the difference between self-interest and the interest of others. This is back to Prahlad's teachings many weeks ago, right? Because you can never know it because you're still thinking that your good, your happiness is different than other people's happiness. Your success depends upon other people's defeat, right? You know, that your religion's truth depends on other people's religions being false. You know, you can expand, you can keep expanding your political system, bit by bit, it's the scene of difference and distinction, and thinking that you can be happy, that your happiness is independent of other people's happiness. That's the point. Thus, they enter darkness, just like the ignorant, like the vimuddha. Vimuddha means extremely foolish. Vimuddha is a term for the most dull person, also is a term for an animal. Vimuddha, like a dull, like a dull animal, no intellect, right? Most likely, from our limited perspective, they probably have more intelligence than we think. But although educated, they go into darkness like the ignorant. They live in darkness. So you say the big universities, the whole culture, and everyone just in darkness, wasting their precious moment of life. He says the ignorant can never at any time liberate themselves, ones that's trapped, as they are the playthings of lustful people and bound. Therefore, this is the conclusion. Actually, next week we'll flesh this out. Therefore, be careful. Don't, actually, he says, asanga, don't be connected to them. People who are the completely worldly. We have to work. We have to deal with people. That's not the thing. He says, oh, children of the demons, do not associate with demons. What does this mean? He says, oh, children of daitas, don't have sangha of daitas. Don't associate with demons. Doesn't mean leave their family, right? In their culture and their family and like jobs. Like that means don't let this thinking come. In childhood and youth, now or wherever we are now, start to worship God, meditate on God, listen, chant, remember, surrender, offer, pray to the Bhagavad Dharma now, right? And don't let this daita mentality, the thinking, come into the mind. Live your life, your full span of 100 years, in a way that you're constantly walking towards the infinite Lord. Next week we'll read verses where he describes how is there? He says, for God's infinite, and you simply touch him, he's immediately there. Darkness, as Sri Ramakrishna said, darkness, a room can be dark 1,000 years, and you light a match, instantly the darkness goes, right? So for God, anything is possible. Anywhere you touch God, you become illumined, right? It's not difficult, right? He says, but when we get trapped, how are we going to get out? How are we going to think of God in the midst of all this? So when we're young, train ourselves now, right? So therefore, stay away from who are very addicted to sense enjoyment. Instead, you should approach Narayana, right? Put your mind instead. In other words, don't put your mind on unbridled worldly endeavor and people who are controlled by unbridled worldly endeavor. Put your mind instead on Narayana. Why? He is the goal. He is the ultimate goal of even those who are free from all attachment. So those who have no attachment, who have nothing, who are completely the mukta vimukta, the liberated people, they're also, their goal is only that. Right? Everyone is searching for that source of real happiness, that source of real pleasure. Right? And so it's not that our desire for pleasure and happiness, that's not at fault. Right, it's knowing our real happiness lies in God, right? And whatever we do as we live our 100-year span of life, and every animal and every species, and in this life, our next life, if there is whatever God wishes, as we progress bit by bit, by remembering God, and we're walking towards the goal, Bhagavad Dharma. So we'll read next week Prahlad Maharaj's instruction on how to do this, how to focus on God. And the benefits, and how meditating on God changes everything. Changes even these demons living in the story, demons living under demonic gurus, right? They also become immediately, they're so simple. They remember God and they become liberated, free, pure. Mrs. Argo, thank you very much for your kind attention. It's nice to go back to this text. We've been missing it last few weeks. Prahlad Maharaj ki jai, Nrisimha Bhagavan ki jai. Jai Bhagavan.